to Paris today, so to speak, with a very gifted author by the name of Eunice Lipton, an art historian, the author of a number of different wonderful books about art, and this very personal memoir, which I hold in my hands, called French Seduction, An American's Encounter with France, Her Father, and the Holocaust. In this book, Eunice Lipton writes very, very honestly about herself, her family, and her relationship with the nation of France, a nation to which she has felt herself drawn over the course of many years, and where she has made her home for many years. But it is also a place which has been frustrating to her, and she has uncovered certain dark corners in the French national cultural life and society, and dark corners in its history as well, as she's come to understand France and the French on an increasingly more profound level, and also her own father's relationship and attitudes about this country. Again, the book is called French Seduction. It is published by Carroll and Graf, and I'm very happy for the next few minutes to be able to speak with Eunice Lipton about this very unique book. Eunice Lipton, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
I'm very pleased to be here.
One of the things you've done here is that I think is so admirable is that you have written about so much here, about your own sort of personal experiences living in France, and about your own family, including you, both of your parents, and you've written about the history of France, and all within the pages of a book which isn't all that large. There's so much here, and somehow it all makes sense, but it couldn't have been easy to try and create a book like this. Tell us how it sort of came about and took shape in this way.
Okay, I will. This is the second book that I wrote like this, and what I think of as like this is I think of my writing, these last two books in particular, as being both autobiography and cultural reverie. And in a way, it comes naturally to me. Maybe because I was psychoanalyzed many years ago, maybe because I value both my own history and history in general, and because when I was a professor of art history, paintings became such a big part of my life, and the history of France became such a big part of my life. I didn't know how to tell a story, or maybe I didn't want to tell a story about my life or about French history that somehow didn't intertwine. And I think that's also related to the years when I really the years in academia, and I'm thinking, I guess, of the 80s, when people began to take seriously that there was no objective way of telling history, that one's life was always a part of it. And my last book, which was about Manet's model for Olympia and others of his paintings, was a story also about my mother and me and my husband and Paris. And it just seemed like the right way to tell a story. And then when I moved to France 8 years ago, and art, of course, remained very much the center of my life because of my own training, although I was no longer a practicing art historian, but I was also married to an artist, and, well, it was France, you know. So there I was living my life in France and having it transformed, even though I had been going there since I was 19 years old. When you live in a place, it's very different than visiting, even when you visit on a sabbatical for 6 months or a year. And there was no way to think about that crunchy baguette that really... I cannot exaggerate what that feels like for an American, you know, even in a New York. I mean, I don't know how it is where you live, but, you know, New York, one thinks, oh, you can get great bread anytime you want. Well, you can't. And when you can regularly get bread that's baked 3-4 times a day, it seeps into your consciousness. Well, Proust is there as an example of how that can happen. And I certainly wouldn't compare myself to Proust, but in a way, I guess in a very profound way, he got under my skin. I mean, that's I guess I am comparing myself. That is the kind of story he tells. It's all wrapped up together. So I appreciate your commenting on this, because it feels like a very important part of my work, but also my life.
Very much so. I'm taken aback by the way in which you write about both of your parents and all of their imperfections without, in a sense, dwelling on them or not writing about them in a way that seems bitter. Although clearly there are ways in which both of them really caused you pain, which you carry to this day. But it strikes me as a very healthy way and just simply an honest way to write about your parents. But I wonder what that experience was like. And did you struggle at all as you actually put down the words on the page to be fair with your parents, to be loving with them, about them, and yet honest about who they were and who they weren't?
Greg, I can't tell you how happy I am to hear you say that, because, in fact, it's been a great struggle in my writing and I think in my personal life to not be just angry. And, in fact, in some way you're picking up on the fact that there was a book that I never published between Alias Olympia and French Seduction, and it was a book about my father and his brother, who had gone to Spain in the late 30s to fight against Franco and who died there, and whose death I held my father in some way responsible for because of the way he acted towards his brother. Obviously, the boy was shot by a sniper, so it wasn't my father who did it. But the book never came right, and even though on the eve of my finally selling it to an agent, I reread it and I realized I can't sell this book because it reeks of hatred towards my father.
Mm.
And I put it aside, and, you know, you interview a lot of writers. You know how hard that is for a writer to... I mean, I had worked on that book for like 8 years or so, and I just put it aside. Now, I don't know if this is related or not, but my father died soon afterwards at a ripe old age. And this new book began to form, and you may remember that there are passages in this book, French Seduction, that are about my father and his brother. So it worked its way in. But to be completely candid, I have to tell you that a year ago, this past Christmas, I finished a draft of the manuscript, and it was due at the publishers in March, and I read it. It was just before Christmas, and I hated the book. I just knew the book was, it wasn't right.
Are we talking now about this book?
Yes, we are. Mm-hmm. We're talking about French Seduction.
Right.
I knew it wasn't right, and I was going to work with an editor on this book, and I was so appalled by the state of the book that I wrote her, and I said, I can't send you the book. And she said to me, Eunice, that's my job. You have to send me the book. And I did, and she wrote me back a 20-page single-spaced letter that was an overview of the whole book and then went chapter by chapter. And basically what she did was every time I would bring up something about my father and not say nearly enough, like at the very beginning of the book, I say something to the effect that my father whispered to me, Eunice, go to Paris, you'll be happy there. And the next sentence is something like, of course, my father had never been there. And Jean Casella, this brilliant editor, said, what do you mean, of course he'd never been there? So every time something like that came up, she pushed me. Hmm. And it was like, as if she were an analyst in a way.
Right. There's a story behind those words that you were reluctant to explore.
Yes, there was a story and there was passion and there was fear of going too deep, which I had done about my mother in the previous book, and I didn't want to do it. And somehow, because she was so good and she wrote me this long, brilliant letter, I felt I could do it because I felt she was holding my hand in a way. But, you know, people don't have edits like this anymore.
Hmm.
And in fact, she didn't work at Carol and Graf, who published the book. She was somebody else who I was working with. Actually, the former publisher of the Feminist Press in New York.
Hmm. So she, it's interesting because one of the images we have in this book is of the mother and of being mothered. And you talk in some respects about France, at least at some points in its past, or for some citizens, being the great mother to its citizens, and its citizens appreciating being mothered, and even by their doctors. I mean, this theme comes up again and again. And in a sense, your relationship with this woman who helped edit this book for you was a similar sort of experience.
You're really great. You know, I was thinking of calling this book before it was finished in the form that it's finished, I was thinking of calling this book Le Baby, because I felt that the theme of mother and mothering so pervaded French culture that I wanted to sort of expose that. And in the book, as you point out, that this thing comes up a lot. I mean, one of the things that struck me very early on when we began to live there, was how dependent the French are on all the senses all the time. They are always touching each other. You know, they're always close together. For example, a line at a bank, a line at the metro, or sitting in the metro, a line at the cinema. Here, we always stand a distance away. And in fact, I've gotten into the bad habit of standing close to people because I live in France now, and when I'm back in New York, where I am at the moment, I tend to get up too close and people look at me very strangely. So, you know, touch, the body is always in proximity. The double kissing on two cheeks all the time. Taste is obvious. Smell, sight, sound. That I had this sense that, well, I asked myself, this rings a bell, I thought. When is it that we get all of these pleasures in our life? And there's only one moment, really, that we get an unmitigated dose of all those pleasures. And if we're lucky, it's when we're an infant. At our mother's breast, touching, smelling, seeing her up close. And then I felt it pervaded their culture, as you said. The pharmacists are mostly women. The doctors are mostly women. The churches, the great churches, are called Notre Dame, Our Lady, and they're about Mary, Marianne, the Republic. In every city, if not every town of France, Proust, Colette, Camus. I mean, mother, 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 mother.
Yeah, absolutely. You say at one point, I had no idea the extent to which the French are in the thrall of their senses and how they do not hesitate to satisfy them. They're like babies. Yeah. And it doesn't take me long to realize that I want exactly what they want.
Yeah, well, that's true. And I think that Anglos who are attracted to France want that.
We're speaking with Eunice Lipton about her book, French Seduction. You mentioned specifically your father in the subtitle of the book. Tell us a little bit about his story and why the sort of jarring shift which he experienced in coming to America, why that perhaps set in motion for him a hunger for what a place like France might have to offer, even though it's a place he never lived.
Yeah, never visited even until I brought him there. My father came, I mean, his beginning story is a story that is part of American history. He came, a Jew with his family from Eastern Europe, Latvia. He grew up in Riga, and he came in 27. He was a teenager, I think a particularly hard time for a boy in particular to adjust. He became a prize fighter and a great dancer, and he met my mother when she was 15 and he was 18, and they got married soon after. And although marriage never agreed with him, he was a very restless man, a very romantic man. And he, like a lot of Eastern Europeans who were even semi-educated, which is what he really was, were in the thrall of France as the great culture. Now, in part, that derives from Russia, which was the first great culture. He came from a family that, first of all, his family were communists, so Russia meant a lot to them that way. But even before then, Russian literature meant an enormous amount to my father. I mean, he had me reading Crime and Punishment when I was, 10 years old, ridiculously young to be rereading that stuff. But the Russians are also very attached to the French. In any case, the idea of romance, the idea of politics, the idea of adventure, all of that got wrapped up with Paris, and he had these images that just kept coming back to him. The Seine, beautiful women, Zola. He didn't talk about the food. He was kind of, a little puritanical that way, strict with himself, I think, because his parents owned a delicatessen store and he wasn't supposed to eat anything.
Imagine.
Yeah, yeah. We were close. I don't know why exactly he chose to be close. We were a brother and a sister, and he was closer to me. I think maybe it was easier to be closer to a girl. Very early on, he just started telling me these stories, and urging me to go there, urging me to go there. I didn't realize, maybe till I wrote the book, that these urgings on his part were that his own, part of it was his own dissatisfaction with living in America, which he ultimately left, but because he didn't have any languages besides English and Yiddish, at that point, where was he going to go? You know, The only place he could go was Israel, and he was never a Zionist, but he ended up in Israel with his second wife.
You point out what ends up being kind of an irony about his fascination with France and that he wanted you to be there. This idea that if France is this place that is so much about sensual pleasures and the satisfaction of our appetite, you say that that's, at least in some ways, was not exactly who he was. You say, for instance, I cannot recall a time when my father tasted something and said, that's terrific. You're going to describe a couple of, you know, mouth-watering meals which were which would be made for him, but that he would sort of take for granted. It just would not occur to him to immerse himself in these kind of experiences and pleasures in a way that you describe as being common for the French.
Yeah, he, as I sort of alluded to before, he wasn't good on food. He was unable to really let himself go that way. His persona was much more a sexual persona. I mean, I'll never know, you know, whether that was just mythic on his part, not the way he actually lived, or whether he really did live that way. But when I was growing up, I always had the vague notion that he was involved with other women, and he was a very very sexual man, preening a lot and walking around the house half naked and never threatening at all. I mean, I never felt threatened by my father physically, but I felt the physical presence. But eating, no, that's true. He would sort of say, oh, that's narishkeit in Yiddish. That's silly. You know, it's nonsense to care that much about food. Unlike my mother, who really did love to eat. I think, though, that France, you see, the romance and physicality, that was something that meant a lot to him in France. So whether it was looking at a beautiful woman, he didn't talk about men, interestingly enough. Of course, he couldn't at that point, right? It would have seemed gay. He talked about the Seine. I don't know where he got it. I guess it's part of the mythic image of France. But not food. No, that's true. For me, frankly, the real contradiction came in with, on the one hand, his urging me to go there, and then when I finally moved, him saying to me, I think the first chapter of the book, he was 89 years old. It was actually I didn't know this, but it was the last time I was going to see him, and he said, as I was leaving, so you moved to Paris. He said, why'd you do that? And I thought, why is he asking me this? My whole life he's been telling me I should move to Paris. You know?
Couldn't quite believe that.
The man doesn't stop driving me crazy.
Interesting.
But I came to realize that it was his fear of anti-Semitism that made him ask me that.
That's an important theme of the book, which we will touch on. In contrasting yourself with your father, you say it in the introduction, if my father was all touch and talk, if that was the way in which he really lived out his life and experienced it most profoundly, sight became your special sense, and it turns out your magic wand. I would appreciate it if you would tell our listeners the story you tell of maybe the first instance in your life as a very, very young child when you realize the power of a searing image, as you see that play out, and I believe your grandparents.
Yes. I must have been, I don't know, 4 or 5. And it was snowy. We were in the Catskills. My grandparents earned a living by they had a big house that they rented, and in the winter, they rented it in the summertime. In the winter, it was pretty much empty except for the three of us. My mother had left me there with them when I was 3. And I was I went out on a sleigh to town with my grandpa, and he pulled me on the sleigh to town, and we came back, and we always had merry, wonderful times. He was a wonderful, sweet man. And also, he had had six sons, four of whom had died, and I think the whole family really was thrilled with having a girl in the family. So we were coming back to town, and when we got to the house, my grandma was standing at the gate, and even though it was freezing cold, she was just wearing her house dress, and she had a newspaper in her hand. And when my grandpa knew something was wrong, he just went up to her, and she said to him, in Yiddish, she said to him, "Take a look at this." And he took a look, and they were both crying, and they dropped this paper to the ground. And I saw, this little child saw these stick figures in what looked like striped pajamas. And, of course, what had dropped to the ground was a Life magazine image of the concentration camp. I mean, I was born in 41, so I was 4 years old. It was 45. And finally, he said, let's go into the house. Eunice would love to have some soup. And the grandma shook herself free, and we went into the house. But even as we sat around the table in the dining room, and we're talking about a very simple house and, you know, simple people, immigrants, basically, good people, simple in terms of their desires, let's say. And it was very quiet at the table and strange, and I found myself looking around the room, and my eyes stopped on probably the one picture, the one frame. There was the only other picture in the house was a big picture of my grandma's father. It was this ominous rabbi, just his face and his beard and everything. But then it wasn't in that room, in the dining room. I saw this other picture, the small picture of a girl stretched out on two chairs and a doctor bending over and her parents behind her. And somehow I knew as a child that something was wrong and that the child was sick and that maybe she was dying. I don't know what a four-year-old could know about dying, but I knew something was terribly wrong. And then that the parents were somehow saying goodbye to this child. And I stayed in the picture for a long time. And then my grandma, I think it was, or my grandpa, put their hand on my face and said, "Have some more soup, sweetheart." And I think that was the moment that I took these terrible emotions and also the fear of losing my grandparents, who had, after all, in the moment of their sorrow, abandoned me, both outside in the snow and even around the table. And I think that was the beginning of my story as an art historian.
I love the sentence, "It is the first time that I remember looking hard at something." Probably I'd done it before, the contrast between the colors, lines, shapes, textures of the Bronx where I lived with my parents and the countryside around my grandparents' home. Must have been extreme. Surely I noticed, even without knowing it, the black greens of pines, their thickly layered coffee-colored barks, the bleach-white snow and blue sky, the call to see compared to the city's drab gray asphalt and mauve brick. But now this is a moment when you realize what it is to really look closely at something, and it, of course, is a precursor of what becomes your life's work, to look at wonderful paintings and to understand them on a level that evades a lot of the rest of us.
Thank you. It was an extraordinary and formative experience. There's no question about it.
Talk for a moment about something else you say, again in the introduction to the book, about what you experience when you study paintings and in a sense immerse yourself in them. You say, "Paintings will become a place for me to repress your feelings of betrayal and abandonment. And paintings also ferry you across them," I guess, across some of those feelings of pain.
Yeah. Well, that experience, I think, with my grandparents was, I don't want to say traumatic, but it was close to that. Because, you see, my mother had left me there, and they were my life. And in the instant when I felt I lost them, I panicked, I'm sure, and floods of very complicated feelings poured over me. And, you know, there's just so much feeling a person can manage in their life. And if we're lucky, we find ways to sublimate the hardest feelings. And I found that in looking. And the repressed part, I think, is just a psychological dynamic where you take something that's unbearable, in French, insupportable. You cannot support it. You cannot bear it. And you put it, you know, you put it someplace else. I do that to such an extent, this almost horrifies me, that when we go hiking, and I love to hike, especially in the south of France, I invariably, when I see something beautiful, I'll tell Ken, my husband, that's just like Monet's painting, or isn't that just like Van Gogh, or doesn't Rembrandt capture color? It's like I almost can't bear any strong emotion without translating it into painting. I mean, I hate to say that. I mean, I'm very happily married, and I think that I have a very rich emotional life. I know I do with my husband. But that is the way I live. I do translate life into painting a lot.
One of the things that is so interesting is what you are able to learn about France and its history and its people, as you experience some of the great painters of its past. I'm thinking, for instance, of when you talk at some length about the painter François Boucher. Is that how we say
yes,
that?
Yes, Boucher. Mm-hmm.
And these paintings, which show us a very sumptuous side of France's past, and your understanding of what those paintings depict changes a bit over time.
Yes.
Tell us about that.
Well, Boucher, first of all, I'm sure most of you listeners know something about Boucher, but let me just say this as an introduction, that his work was typical of the court of Louis XV, Louis the XV, and Madame de Pompadour, who was his mistress. And the great patron of Boucher. So the sumptuousness in Boucher's painting is part and parcel of court life and aristocratic life. And I will always used to think, before I took a closer look at Boucher, I always thought, like any good leftist and feminist, that his paintings were a sign of why the revolution had happened in the first place, that this was unearned pleasure. Anyway, after I finished the book on Degas and the working women in Degas' paintings, I found myself looking at Boucher, these four gorgeous paintings at the Frick Collection in New York, and loving them, just loving them. The sumptuousness, the permissiveness, and it all revolved around femininity, but I don't mean that in any you know, monolithic sense, but just the kind of softness and a physicality that wasn't really going anywhere. It was just about pleasure and something that's associated with the feminine that hopefully a lot of men have these nowadays, too. And I developed this whole, maybe, that turns out maybe is a kind of wacky idea, but it worked at the time, that these paintings represented the increased power of women, because it turns out that, in fact, women in the 18th century, rich women in the 18th century who were part of court life, had a certain amount of power in the salons that they organized, where political and literary and scientific people, men, went. And so I developed this whole argument about how that female power and desire was in those paintings. But as I did more and more research, I had to come to the conclusion, although there are people who don't agree with me here, I had to come to the conclusion that the women really didn't have much power, that it was always secondary to traditional and masculine power. And so I finally had to admit that my original insight, that the paintings were really about the power of the of royalty. However, what I took out of that, and I think I'm right here, of course it's just a hunch, what I took out of that was that the pleasure that was for the very rich at that time, and that is in those gorgeous, I think, gorgeous Boucher paintings, was something that became available after the revolution. I mean, part of the revolution was to spread it around. And in fact, French life today, you could say, is very much a result of the way the appetites, all the senses of the court became possible for all the French.
It's interesting, too, and as you talk about Boucher, you talk at one point about luxury and the way in which the French then, and now for that matter to some extent, look at luxury not as something superfluous or degenerate. Far from it. You say the more splendid, the more honorable it is.
Yeah, I think they're wonderful that way. And even people who don't have lots of money try to live, not a necessarily a luxurious life, but they try to make their lives sumptuous in the way that they can. That is, they'll make a good meal. A great example of that actually is in Zola's L'Assommoir, where these, working people get married and they run through the Louvre on their wedding day with all of their friends on the free day at the Louvre, and then they come home and they eat a great meal. Here are these poor people eating a meal that would make any mouth water. So they do appreciate, they're self-indulgent. They are self-indulgent. It was no longer for just the king and his entourage. It was, it could be for everybody.
Mm. You write also about Impressionist paintings, I think, in such an interesting way, and point out quite rightly that that's for as uncultured as a lot of we Americans tend to be, that most of us at least know enough about Impressionism to be able to sort of recognize it when we see it. You say at one point something so intriguing, that the Impressionists promise real life, but it is a false promise, that in fact they are giving us just a small little sliver of the truth, and yet it is something which really intrigues us and draws us in a way that maybe a lot of other styles of painting do not.
We want that truth, and I say we as Americans. We want, I don't mean the truth, but the truth of Impressionist painting. We want the funniness. We want the no working. We want the great food on the table. We want people forever young. Of course we became the greatest buyers of Impressionist painting. I mean, they don't have anywhere near in France the number of Impressionist paintings that we have in every great museum of this country. I think that there's something in our Protestantism, even if we're Jewish or Catholic or Muslim or whatever, that makes us yearn for that life. And it began to bug me in a way that everybody was always young, that nobody ever was working, with the exception of Degas. When you think of Impressionist painting, you think of sunny paintings. But if you live in France, in Paris rather, you know that the weather is very much like London. It is a gray city to a very great extent. I mean, winter is almost unbearable. It's so gray. And yet, try to think of one gray painting. I mean, maybe you'll come up with really.
That's true, isn't it?
So there, encapsulated, you have the lie, if you will, of Impressionism. Now, lies are wonderful things also, I don't hate Impressionist paintings by far. But, you know, once you realize just that simple thing about the climate, you see the extent of the distortion. And then if you learn about the social history of France in those years, you also, you find out about the tearing up of the city, the upheaval in terms of labor, the numbers of artisans that are insane asylums because of the surge of industrialism. And you look at the paintings and they just, it's not there. Now, look, art doesn't have to tell you everything. By far, and no one is going to stop liking Impressionist painting because of what I've just said, because we live on dreams and fantasy. And what's more, they also live like that. You can have that in France. I mean, that's why, despite my problems with the country, I love living there. It's a corny thing to say, but they know how to live.
That idea of eluding the truth, certainly is spoken of in your book when you talk about, for instance, more recent French history, and in particular, the way in which you believe France never fully came to terms with the trauma of the First World War. And you suggest that that had a whole lot to do with how France sort of lived out the 20s in such wild abandon, and how in the late 1930s they capitulated so quickly to Germany in a way that, that other nations did not. I mean, you trace at least some of this troubling stuff in their history back to the way in which they did not fully come to terms with what had come before.
That was, I would say, the great discovery of the book for me in the 20s. I had no idea what the 20s were like. The 20s were like our Roaring 20s in my mind, which is, of course, also absurd, how many people were involved with in the Roaring 20s and how many people were just living their normal lives. But to me, it had all of the glamour, not only of, Hemingway and Fitzgerald and Gertrude Stein being in Paris, but the Eastern European artists coming to Paris, and all those lesbians who could live free lives, and the dancing and the short hair and the short skirts and all of that. And I knew, yes, I knew about Dada, and knew that that was a response to the war and the horrors of that trench warfare. But it didn't somehow figure. But then I began to notice all these, in every town in France, even a small village, you have these monuments to the war. And I thought, what is it about this war? Because we, of course, for us, the Great War was the Second World War, not the first one. And what I learned was the extent to which that war had destroyed the population, but destroyed really the French soul. And their response to the war, outside of the small sliver of culture that roared through the 20s, I think that their response to the war, which made them go home again to the peasants being the most important part of French life, the family, the mother and the father, the church, all of that began to set the foundation, I now believe, for their capitulation to the Germans and to Nazism. Hmm. That the French are not good at being honest with themselves. they're not good at being self-critical. And they suffered the losses and the anguish and the trauma of what happened, even though they won the war. And they repressed it and pulled out instead their nationalism, and became, already in the 20s, terribly anti-Semitic. I mean, writing horrible things about artists. This really shocked me. And I learned it primarily through this great book by an artist by the name of Romy Golan. And the 20s ruined them. And I do believe that they never recovered. I think the 20s for them is like slavery for blacks in this country and the Holocaust for Jews. Mm. And that, because they never opened up that wound, and how they patched it up with their nationalism, which then carried them through the Germans, and I mean, I'm oversimplifying now, but it made them, it's not that it made them, but it continued a distaste that they have for outsiders. Mm. That's the only way I can put it, whether they're Jews or today Arabs.
Well, and that is something else which you talk about, of course, in your book. At one point you say, I am haunted by my own otherness in France. And this is something which you have tasted in a number of different ways. You also write of how Paris, in many respects, has changed in very recent years from what it once was, a place that is not quite so polite and civil, a place that seems a bit darker and angrier. What would you say is your relationship with Paris right now? I mean, is it still a place you enjoy being in, living in, and calling part of your life?
Yeah, I do.
For all that.
I do. And I do because I want to believe in the great promise of the French Republic. I mean, I'm almost becoming French myself in that way. You know, the Republic was pulled, you know, out of the 18th century, and it was meant to establish the rights of all people. At that time, it was men, but now it's all people. And men and women from all over the world came to France since the 18th century to have that liberty, equality, fraternity. And if you look at French life, and never mind just the sensual pleasures, if you look at the way in which the French state takes care of French citizens, yes, through high taxes, but frankly, I wouldn't mind paying them to have the kind of medical care that they have, and housing, and pensions, and paid vacations. And I find, au fond, at bottom, I find that the French want to provide that kind of humanity, humanism, for everybody. They are blocked, however, by their own distaste of outsiders, and they are in a terrible struggle over that, which they are losing at the moment.
Hmm.
And the way you sense, the way I sense that they're losing it, is in a very kind of blunt contrast between London and Paris.
Hmm.
Yeah.
It'll be interesting to see how that plays out in the coming years, and where France goes from here, and whether it comes to grips with itself and with its past. This book explores so much of this in such rich and remarkable detail. Again, it's called French Seduction, An American's Encounter with France, Her Father, and the Holocaust, published by Carolyn Graf and the author Eunice Lipton. Eunice Lipton, I loved this book, every page, and I'm so glad we got to talk about it today on the morning show. And best wishes to you and with all of the future writing to which we can look forward.
Thank you so much, Greg. It's been a pleasure, really a pleasure.
That wraps up today's edition of the WGTD Morning Show. Greg Berg is currently conducting another interview on the phone. He'll be along with the Music Potpourri momentarily. We'll be right back. 9 o'clock. This is WGTD 91.1 FM, Kenosha Racine. News and classical music on your gateway to public radio. My name is Dave McGrath. Greg Berg will be along momentarily with the Music Potpourri. He is in our other studio conducting a phone interview. Quick check on the WGTD forecast from the National Weather Service. For this Thursday, 1st of March, cloudy, windy, and rainy, scattered thunderstorms, snow showers and sleet, and steady temperatures in the mid-30s. Most of the storm now is over the lake. We had some pretty dicey weather between 6:30 and 8:30 this morning. For those of you who are looking out the window now wondering what's going on, we had thunderstorms this morning, we had lightning, and a good mix of rain and sleet, so the roads were very slushy and slippery earlier this morning. Looks like they're clearing up okay now. Currently 34 degrees in both Racine and Kenosha.
And we welcome you to the Music Potpourri on WGTD 91.1 FM. I'm Gregory Berg. And we're going to open up today's Music Potpourri with the Hungarian composer Miklós Rozsa, who is without a doubt best known for his film music, for some of the most important films of the 20th century, but he has a number of so-called classical works or concert works to his credit as well. And we're going to hear one of them now off of a Koch compact disc, his theme variations and finale, composed in 1933. And this will be with the New Zealand Symphony Orchestra and James Sedaris conducting.